From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. This may be up for debate, but football is America's true pastime. More people tune into football than any other sport in the United States. This tradition is part of the fabric of many families and childhoods. But in recent years, the health and safety of players has been called into question, with more research being devoted to understanding how blows to the head can increase the risk for chronic brain disease. A bill in California wanted to limit youth tackle football due to these concerns, and it sparked passionate debate between those concerned about the long-term risk to chronic brain disease, as well as parental rights, among other arguments that have been made. I'm using the past tense because this bill has been effectively stopped in its tracks by Governor Gavin Newsom. Cap Radio healthcare reporter Kate Wolf explains why the governor said he would veto the legislation if it passed the state legislature. Hey, Kate.
Hi, Vicky.
Okay, so we talked about this bill almost a year ago on Insight back in March of 2023. Remind us what this legislation hoped to accomplish and why we're still talking about it in 2024.
Right. So the legislation was made into a 2-year bill, which is why we are still talking about it. And the goal of it was to phase tackle out for kids under 12 over the course of 4 years, starting in 2025. That's a lot of numbers. So if the bill had passed, it would have banned tackle football for kids under 6 in 2025, and then banned it for kids under 8 in 2027, and so forth up to 12.
Mm. And your journey specifically when it comes to covering this piece of legislation, it started with a hearing that was held earlier this month at the state capitol. So it's kind of developed momentum in the months, you know, since we last talked about this on Insight. So it seems like it was a pretty passionate event. So tell us about it.
Right. So the hearing at the Capitol was, to me, really an encapsulation of this struggle. There were dozens of families there, some kids in football gear, and there were neurologists and folks who were really supporting this, the passage of this bill. Lawmakers heard from Kevin McCarty, who is an assembly member who keeps putting forward this bill, really is advocating for it. He's also a mayoral candidate for Sacramento. And McCarty brought forward a woman named Dr. D. Polani Lucas, whose son was Stanley Wilson Jr., who played college ball at Stanford and then 3 seasons in the NFL for the Detroit Lions. So Lucas said that her son had been courageous, funny, he loved God, he loved his family. But then she described how he changed.
I supported my adult son as he suffered with mental illness, drug addiction, suicidal thoughts, and self-destructive behavior that ultimately resulted in his incarceration. He spent the final months of his life in the custody of the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, where he died under suspicious circumstances.
And Wilson was 40 years old when he died.
Yeah, and that is just a tragic example of when having this conversation, you know, I have learned that, you know, people are connecting chronic brain disease. I mean, it can happen years after you actually play the sport, which makes it really difficult to actually link. And that's why there's more research from the NIH. You know, the NIH, the recent research I was looking at, you know, they're looking at the evidence between CTE and tackling. So what is CTE within the brain?
So CTE is short for chronic traumatic encephalopathy. It's a degenerative brain disease, right? So it's not an injury. It's actually a disease that's triggered by many injuries. It's associated with repeated head impacts. And it is a bit of a mystery, which allows for there to be this ambiguity around it, allows for a little bit of deniability. And the way they diagnose CTE is after someone dies, they take a slice of that brain and identify some of the telltale signs.
So it can't be diagnosed when someone's alive.
Exactly.
I've also heard of TBI, that's traumatic brain injury. How does this relate to CTE?
So it was thought for a long time that if you got a bunch of concussions, you were more at risk for CTE. But researchers have found actually that it's subconcussive hits that also can have a serious impact. And these are just hits that you get when you're tackling someone to the ground, your head hits the turf and you bounce up when, you know, you go head to head against someone. So these are things that kids might not even notice as a big deal. Parents, coaches might not even notice, but they are causing insidious harm.
Mm. And it's not just football. It can be other sports as well, and not even sports. But what exactly causes CTE, and how does it look when someone actually actually has it.
Right. So I talked to Stella Lagarda about this. She's a practicing pediatric neurologist, and she described a little bit of what is happening in the brain when CTE is building to when you would get CTE. So here's how she described it.
It's like your cables to your computer are all frayed and broken, all right? But the computer still works. You just have to kind of put things together in the cables. But over time, you're going to need a new computer. We can't get a new brain.
So when those cables are frayed and broken, they cause difficulty in brain functioning, and they end up forming tau protein deposits, which are similar to those we see in adults with Alzheimer's and other dementias. So what it might look like with someone is, you know, changes in behavior, impulsivity, forgetting things, cognitive impairment, that tends to come later. But we are seeing this too in people who didn't play in the NFL, people who were just amateur players who stopped after high school and college. So evidence is also showing that the younger you start, the more at risk you can be. And I'll also say CTE doesn't show up in everyone. So two people could play the same career, and one person could have CTE and one person could not. So it's still something that's having a lot of research.
And the reason why we're talking about this, at the center of this conversation, is youth tackle football. What are the current rules and requirements in California for youth tackle football?
So as there's become this pressure to ban it, there's youth tackle football for kids under 12. There's been a push by the California Youth Football Alliance to increase some of the safety protections. So AB1 passed in 2019. It went into effect 3 years ago, and it made it so that there's lots of extra training for coaches. There's an on-ramp for kids to get conditioning, safety inspections for helmets and pads, and it really, really limits full contact football games during practice. So you can only play for 30 minutes per day and only twice per week, full contact football like you would play at a game.
So there already was a piece of legislation that was signed into law relatively recently, 2021. This bill has been effectively stopped in its tracks. Before we get to the reason why, over the last, year plus, it did spark a lot of passionate debate. So what stood out to you about the arguments that were made for and against this bill?
So I'll just say that the AB1, which I just mentioned, which added a ton of safety protections, that was actually put forward by former assembly member Jim Cooper, who is now Sacramento County's sheriff. So that's a big argument against this bill, is we need to give more time for this legislation to take effect, to start seeing the impacts of these increased protections. Assemblymember McCarty, who put forward this bill banning tackle football for kids under 12, says there's no safe knock to the head for a child 7, 8, 9. We should not be exposing our kids this young to these subconcussive knocks. And Jim Cooper came out to this hearing and he fought back and he said it's not just about the game. It's about more than that. And here's what he testified to.
The confidence, mental well-being, and life skills fostered through the sport, particularly within the underserved communities, are immeasurable. For some adolescents, youth tackle football serves as their sole source of structure, offering positive role models and guiding them toward a positive and productive path. I personally witnessed numerous individuals from underserved communities attribute their success later in life to the tools gained through youth tackle football.
All right. So we just heard from lawmakers, former lawmakers, as well as neurologists. These are all adults. At the center of this are children as well as their families. How are they thinking about this issue? Were they even aware that a bill like this was making its way through the state capitol?
The answer to that is no. From what I knew, the kids on the ground were not aware that this bill was happening. There were some, of course, who showed up to the hearing to voice opposition. But I went to a practice in Tahoe Park here in Sacramento because I really wanted to talk to kids about their experience playing football and what they were thinking about. I talked to 12-year-old Kainoa Navarrete, and here's a little bit of our conversation.
Yeah, I'm kind of concerned a lot sometimes.
You get worried sometimes?
Yeah, I do get worried a lot.
When was the last time you were worried about your head?
probably like a month ago, like in games, because sometimes I get hit in the head a lot and it kind of stings, like a headache.
And is that when you're wearing a helmet?
Yeah, still when I'm wearing a helmet, you can still feel it.
So you can't really hear the shock in my voice, but as someone who has never played football before, I was kind of shocked hearing that, you know, you hurt your head all the time playing football. And Navarrete was really wise. He was saying it might be a good idea to ban football for kids under 12, but he was heartened by the safety protections. It was just a great conversation. I think a lot of kids see both sides and they love to play, but they're also worried.
Yeah, and that's completely understandable. You know, I didn't play football either, but I had a lot of friends who did, and I just go back to high school, never really thought about, you know, when they would mention, you know, the tackling, you know, the injuries, the head injuries, and just continuing to play. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're talking with CAP Radio healthcare reporter Kate Wolf about a bill that would have limited youth tackle football in California. It is not moving forward at the state legislature. Okay, so it seems like this is going to stay as a parental decision. Governor Newsom, I mean, recently he said that he would veto the bill if it got to his desk, which effectively killed it. So what did you learn about his reasoning?
So Governor Newsom last week told Politico that he would totally veto this if it reached him. He said he's deeply concerned about the health and safety of the young athletes, but an outright ban isn't the answer. He said he'd work with the legislature to strengthen safety in youth football and ensure parents have the freedom, right? That's very important to parents in California. Has become increasingly important is this conversation about parental rights. So he's kind of hitting the buzzwords there. He does say he plans to consult with health and sports medicine experts to make sure that kids are safe. I will also say that he vetoed a proposal in 2022 from Kevin McCarty to study CTE. So he's really invested in letting this AB1, which would strengthen protections and safety in youth football, take effect. And he's pushing back against a lot of the CTE rhetoric.
You know, the timeliness of this as well. I mean, it follows the peak of the pandemic when the state just shut down. And I remember when covering that and covering press conferences with the California Department of Health, there was a lot of comments because these press conferences were virtual from families because they were very critical about youth sports and kids not being able to play during this time. Do you think that the timeliness, I mean, it's only been 4 years, you know, kind of plays into that decision when it comes to youth tackle football?
Definitely. I think that there's, as I mentioned, you know, parents are really worried that that the governor is going to overreach and, you know, things like the legacy of closing schools and like eliminating practices for a while. I think, you know, the governor is really sensitive to that.
Hmm. It's also an election year. So do you think that has any impact behind, you know, his public statement that he would veto the legislation?
Definitely. I talked to Robin Swanson about that. She's a Democratic strategist. And she said that Newsom is a surrogate for President Biden. Anything he does is going to be seen as an extension of Biden. So here's more of what she said.
I think this is a very politically astute governor, and he knows that this could very easily be a zinger in a debate. It could be a one-liner from Ron DeSantis, you know, trying to pick a fight with him. And he just doesn't want this fight right now.
And Swanson called this a Hail Mary pass that no one wants to catch. And she also said that, you know, whenever Democrats would talk about Republicans banning books, she anticipates they would come back and talk about Democrats banning football. So that's a big thing that she said. Newsom does not want this on his desk.
When it comes to the bill's author, Assemblymember Kevin McCarty, what does he say in response? Where does this go from here? I do know that, I mean, it is rare, but the state legislature can override a governor's veto. This is all hypothetical right now because it's still needed to move through the legislature. That is a steep hill, but is that even a possibility for him?
I think it could have been a possibility, but McCarty said he's not moving forward with this. He, he took the governor's note and he's saying, sure, I'll work with you on better protecting our youngest athletes. but I think he probably stands by his previous statement that no hit is a safe one. You know, this is not McCarty's first time putting this forward. He put something forward in 2018 along these lines, and he did want to study CTE in 2022. So I don't see him giving this up, but it is dead for now.
At the heart of this are children, families. What did you learn from them about the role and the value that football adds to their lives?
I talked to some parents who said, my kid watches football as soon as he wakes up to as soon as he falls asleep. That's all he talks about. It's all he's thinking about. You know, it's really consuming for a lot of kids and families. And it brings people together, right? Their daughter can cheerlead. Their son can play football.
And also play flag football in high school now.
There you go. Exactly. Great point. They can watch it together. Social opportunities, coaching opportunities. I think there's a lot of infrastructure around this sport. And, you know, I think there's also something I was really struck by, and in the days after doing a lot of this reporting, is I was just struck by the lack of other options for kids who are in underserved communities, including some of the kids I talked to at Tahoe Park. I think it was really encapsulated in this conversation I had with 9-year-old Waylon Parker.
I play track for like 6 months, and then I quit so I can play tackle football.
And did you not like track?
No, I love track. I kept on forcing my dad to go to track, but he just had work to do, so we can just go to tackle football and my coach can pick me up.
And I don't mean to read too much into that. I don't really know too much about Parker's family situation, but I will say that, there are other sports for these kids to be playing that are not about tackling and hurting their bodies, especially under 12. And I think, I was just struck by the lack of options there.
Kate, thanks for your reporting.
Thank you, Vicky.
That is CAP Radio healthcare reporter Kate Wolf discussing a bill that would have limited youth tackle football under the age of 12 that is no longer moving forward at the state legislature after Governor Newsom said he would veto the bill if it passed. Up next, Sacramento has lost a trailblazing figure. We'll remember the life and the legacy of Lauren Hammond, the first Black woman ever elected to the city council, and how she mentored a new generation of leaders. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. A trailblazing leader in Sacramento has passed away. Former council member Lauren Hammond died unexpectedly last Thursday night at the age of 68. She was the first Black woman ever elected to the city council, where she served for 13 years from 1997 until 2010. That's on top of over her two decades of work here at the California State Senate and holding positions on a variety of boards and organizations. But Hammond was not just a public official. She also served as an inspiration and a mentor for the upcoming generations of women in leadership. Joining us to remember the late council member are leaders who also previously spent time on the city council. State Senator Angelique Ashby, who now represents California's 8th District, current city council member Mai Vang, and former Sacramento Mayor Heather Fargo. Thank you all for being here.
Thanks so much for having us.
Well, Senator Ashby, I want to start with you. You were quoted as calling the late Lauren Hammond a titan. What do you mean by that? How did you first come into contact with her?
I met Lauren Hammond because our service in the city of Sacramento overlapped by 2 weeks. She was on her way out and I was on my way in. And she helped me get a really good start, and we became friends right away. But what I mean by a titan is that Lauren Hammond is, you know, a person who was a first, the first woman to win election as an African-American in the city of Sacramento. There was an African-American member of the council before her, but she was appointed. So Lauren was the first to actually win the seat in an election. And I can't imagine how difficult that was and the barriers and hurdles she had to overcome. How that translates forward is for the rest of us. I mean, you have the first Hmong female on this call, too. And Lauren gave her advice and was there every step of the way with her. For 7 years, I was the only woman on the Sacramento City Council. So people like Mayor Fargo, who you have on this call, and Councilmember Lauren Hammond helped me. And so we were all less alone because we had Lauren Hammond in our lives.
Yeah. And when it comes to that lone position that you've experienced as an elected leader, I mean, that continues also in the current work you're doing. You're the first woman that was elected to this district in the state Senate. Lauren Hammond also had, you know, experience in the state Senate as well. I mean, how did that influence you or as you continued to pursue, you know, elected office?
When you decide to run for office, but especially when you're moving from one seat to another, you have a real honest conversation with yourself about who do you think will walk this journey with you. And sometimes you're right about the people you think will be there with you, and sometimes you're wrong. And I always tell young candidates, but you'll be surprised both ways. You'll be equally surprised. There will be people that show up and support you that you didn't think would be there. There will also be people you thought would be there who disappoint you. But Lauren Hammond is a person who walked that journey with me. She was an early supporter. She came on strong. She never missed my events. She would call me when she saw my name in a headline, good or bad, either to encourage me to keep going or to congratulate me on work well done. And you just, you know, I've said this to a number of people about her in the last few days, but in this life, no matter what you do, there aren't a lot of people that are interested in the details of everything going on in your world, that they're paying attention to what committee assignments you got or how many votes you got on your bill or whatever it is that's important to you. But for me, Lauren Hammond was one of those people. And I talked to her often. In fact, I talked to her the day before she died. I talked to her the day she died. And I just wasn't ready to say that goodbye, and I'm going to miss her a lot. And in the days and weeks to come, as I think about the changes that are happening in the Senate, she would have been one of the main people I would have been talking to about that. And that's a huge loss for me, but I'm not alone. And I said this, you know, in one of the publications too, that I feel really sorry for the young women on the city council now, Councilmember Vang and Talamantas and Maple, and they lost somebody, too, that they could turn to, that they could ask for help or support or suggestions. And they're getting ready to face a really tough budget and be the first time that most of them have to face a deficit. And it's really important to have someone you can trust that you can talk to. So that list just got a little shorter for all of us.
Well, Councilmember Vang, I want to turn to you. You know, what was your relationship with Lauren Hammond?
Well, first, thank you so much for having me on. And Senator Ashby, I just thank you so much. I know we miss Lauren so much, but I also want to just say thank you to you for your mentorship as well over the years. I'm just so grateful that I actually that I had the opportunity to be mentored by her. You know, being the first is hard, right? And I think in so many ways, so many of us are the first in our family, in our community. But Lauren really paved the way for so many of us so that we could be here today. And I'm going to miss her. I'm going to miss her a lot. As Senator Ashby said, you know, our list is smaller now because she's no longer here with us. And, you know, the first time I met Lauren was actually through Councilmember Carr, because they were really good friends. And when I decided to run for city council, I actually reached out to her for her support and her blessing. And she didn't hesitate. I think it would have been a really tough decision for her to endorse me too, because I didn't know her up to that point. But she really believed in me and in our heart and hustle. And she stood by my side. And, you know, even now, during when I was a councilwoman, she would check in on me. That's hard. Like, there's not so many people that
do check in on you, right? Maybe they call you to the, if they want something, but Lauren always just called to just check in and make sure that we were all right, because she's been there before. I think it's been really sad for a lot of us on the city council. For I think about the conversations I have with Councilwoman Maple and Karina Talamantes and Katie Valenzuela. I think it's hit us all really, really hard because of her service, her mentorship over the years, right? I mean, we've begun to see progress in Sacramento region because of her. We see more women, more elected women of color being able to access spaces where decisions are being made. And a lot of that is because she paved the way for so many of us. And I really believe I wouldn't be here today without her love and her support. So many of us, right? And so just really, really grateful that I actually had the opportunity to work with her, to be mentored by her, and really hoping that I can continue to do that for others as well.
Yeah, I mean, what I'm hearing from you and also from Senator Ashby is that obviously, you know, Lauren Hammond wasn't just ensuring that she was the first, but that she wasn't the only one. And this transcended well beyond, you know, her own career, helping the careers of other women.
Way beyond her own career. You know, she ran for assembly and unfortunately didn't win. And one of my big laments is I came on the scene just a little too late to help her. I wish I would have got there 1 year earlier because I think I could have helped her. But she was going it alone, you know, and she had some support, but not like one of us would have now. Not like I got to have because I had her and Mayor Fargo and Councilmember Vang and Councilmember Talamantes and all of these women that have come here because we're standing on the shoulders of these giants. And I think that Lauren made a choice, right? After she lost her race, she could have walked away and no one would have blamed her. Instead, she dug in deeper and took positions with women's organizations like the National Women's Political Caucus. And that gave her opportunity to prop up the rest of us and continue to support us. She parlayed both her victories and her losses into gains for us.
That's wonderful. Mayor Fargo, I want to get to you. I mean, you served alongside the late council member. How are you remembering her?
Well, certainly I share the same sense of loss that everyone does. And I had also been texting with her the day before she passed away. You know, she was really feisty and a really strong advocate for her district. But she also worked beyond that. And she was a real partner to me on the council once she joined. She had part of what I'm remembering about her is part of why she was so effective is that she was fun and playful and very vibrant and very smart. But she was also willing to help other people on the projects that they had in their districts. And I remember when we were doing retreats on the council and trying to figure out, you know, which parts of the city were going to get the new community centers and libraries. And, you know, we both very much supported Bonnie Pinnell in getting the new library, you know, for the Laguna Valley High Library down there, which initially wasn't getting enough votes from the council. And so we kind of conspired to get enough. But she was one of, and I use the word conspire because she's the kind of person that you could, you know, would not only be able to meet with and work with in a public setting, but then afterwards say, okay, what just happened? And then think about, okay, how do we fix this? You know, how do we get around that? Or how do we, you know, which one of us is going to talk to so-and-so? And she also took on some really tough issues. I mean, she was the first one to bring up putting cameras in police cars. And that was before most places in the nation were doing that. And she brought up the idea of putting, you know, cameras on police officers. And she advocated for arresting the Johns that were soliciting prostitutes rather than the prostitutes. And so she had some, you know, very kind of controversial issues that she was willing to take on and advocate for. But she was just a great partner in working on all these things. And for both of us, after we left public office, I'm kind of the one that dragged her into the National Women's Political Caucus leadership. And she would blame me for that if she was here still. So I have to acknowledge that. But
Mayor Fargo drags us all in, for the record.
But, you know, she did just a great job as the leader of that organization for 4 years. Because she was a woman of color, it opened the door for so many other women of color to join our organization and get more involved in supporting women of any color running for office in the Sacramento region. And I just, you know, I really remember the twinkle in her eye that she got when she had like an idea that she wanted to share, or, you know, a reaction that she had. She just was great, you know. And while we did have one appointed African-American before her, afterwards, we then had Bonnie Pinnell, who had a lot of very similar traits and attributes. But again, we got a lot done. We got a lot done for the city of Sacramento, and she had a lot to do with that.
You know, what I'm learning from the three of you is not only was she effective, you know, but often sometimes with elected positions, you know, it can feel impersonal to constituents and you kind of miss the human element. But she was very much human, and it came with sincerity as well. And that's something that you can't really teach, you know, and she was very effective at that as well.
Right. And she also, you know, she had her priorities right. She, you know, she was very involved with her family. You know, very committed to her family and making sure that she took time for that. Very proud of her alumni status with Sac State. She'd be upset if we didn't mention Sac State, I think, today. you know, she was just a great friend all the way around, both politically and personally. And I'm going to miss her just like the rest of us will.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we are joined by State Senator Angelique Ashby, current City Council member Mai Vang, and former Sacramento Mayor Heather Fargo to remember the late trailblazing council member Lauren Hammond, who passed away last week at the age of 68. I would love to talk about the changing face of politics locally. I mean, right now, the Sacramento City Council is majority female. You have 5 out of the 8 seats that are women. In West Sacramento, the entire City Council, including the mayor, are all women. Is this just more of a headline to you, or does that have a deeper meaning to all three of you? Mayor Fargo?
Oh, I think it has a deeper meaning. When I first got on the council in 89, I became the 5th woman in the first time we had, and the only other time we had, a female majority. That lasted for about 2 years, and then I became the only woman on the city council for a couple of years. But I think that there's a lot of people that frankly trust women in politics more than men these days. I think that women have certainly been able to both learn the strategies and techniques of being electable and doing their homework and being ready. And I think that you know, we are more than 50% of the population, and we're certainly more than 50% of the voters. So I think that people are ready to see more women in leadership. And I think that that's reflected both in West Sacramento and Sacramento. Part of it is that people are comfortable with that. And part of it is we have really good candidates. Mm-hmm. So the candidates that are running are ready, they're prepared, they're effective when they get there. And so people are seeing that it's okay to elect women.
Yeah, Senator Ashby, you've kind of gone through this like ebb and flow where, you know, I think the last time there was a women majority council was like in the late 80s and early 90s. And now we're back. And you talked about how at one point you were the lone female on city council. Is this more of a headline? What kind of meaning does it have for you when you look around and you see that it's drastically different?
It's so much more than a headline. First of all, I spent the majority of my time, I spent 12 years on the Sacramento City Council, and the majority of the time that I was there, I was the only woman. The men rotated. They weren't the same men. They were all different men. Same seats, but different men came through those seats over and over and over again. There was actually a point where I personally said to myself, that's enough. We have got to invest in some of these women that are out there that would be interested in doing these positions, but for whatever reason are not taking that next step. And I went to people like Mayor Fargo, and we started pouring into the Mai Vangs and Karina Talamantes and Katie Maples and Portia Middletons of the world. And I think one thing you'll find is that if you looked at, say, my races back in was in 2010, 2009, or you go back to the period of time when Lauren ran or when Mayor Fargo ran, they didn't have as many women to lean on. They had to find men who would be willing to help open some doors for them, or they had to kick it down those doors themselves. And I had to do the same. Now, that's not to say that the current group of women have had every door open for them. They haven't. They still have to kick some in. But there are plenty already off the hinges that Mayor Fargo or Lauren Hammond or myself kicked in for them. And having that network of women to just push for you, it's so helpful. So when I look at Councilmember Valenzuela and Councilmember Talamantes and Maple and Councilmember Vang and Councilmember Kaplan, who now serve as a majority female on there, they have each other. And what's important about that is no two of them are the same. Their politics are not the same. Their backgrounds are not the same. They're not. Their histories are not the same. When you're the only one there, as Mayor Fargo would tell you, and as I can tell you, you have this dubious responsibility of representing all womankind. But there are so many things that I am not. I am not Black. I am not Hmong. I am not a lesbian. I am not old and I am not young. I'm not single. I don't, my life is just my life, right? And there was a great need to have the daughter of immigrant farm workers, to have the daughter of refugees, to have some single people, to have a different generation represented on those dioceses. And it's true in the state Senate as well. There's one Black woman in the California State Senate and one Black man. That is not right. We've never had a female governor. This is the state of California. Hopefully that changes this go round. But those changes don't happen by accident. And they don't happen because of a headline. They happen because the Lauren Hammonds and the Heather Fargos of the world come through and help the Angelique Ashbys and the My Vangs.
Mm-hmm. Councilmember Vang, I know you wanted to chime in as well.
Yeah, well, one, I just want to say I'm grateful to have Senator Ashby and Mayor Fargo still here with us. And, you know, I know I had shared this with Lauren, and I know she's listening as well. But, given that we have Senator Ashby and Mayor Fargo here with us, I just want to reiterate how much I appreciate their love, their support, and their mentorship. And I'm absolutely proud to be serving alongside the majority women council. I would say, so many of us have already been taking care of our families and our communities for centuries, right? And that as women leaders, we are enough and we have always been ready to lead. But I do believe, though, and Senator Ashby touched upon this as well, really the intersectionality of our multiple identities. That matters because it informs how we govern, how we see the world. And when I think about Lauren Hammond, I think about her identities, her multiple identities of being a woman, being African-American. You know, she brought a perspective for transformative change that needed to happen in our community. And what she brought was also, she also understood like the multiple different perspectives through her own lived experiences. And that's what we need on the city council, right? We need that intersectionality of understanding multiple experiences that can uplift all of our families. And so I'm just really honored to be serving alongside a majority woman council. But like Senator Ashby said, we're all so different, but we do have each other's back because we know how hard it is just to be in that seat for the people and how hard it took us to get to that moment and how many more doors we still have to knock down, right? And even as a majority woman council, when I speak to young girls, they're still, I can sense that they're still scared and they don't think it's still possible. But when they see folks like Senator Ashby and myself and the majority woman council, it gives them hope. And that's what it's really all about, right? Making sure we lift as we climb and opening all doors for all the little girls out there.
Well, I want to thank all three of you for just giving us a very small glimpse of the force that was Lauren Hammond. Thank you so much for the conversation.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you,
Vicki.
And that is State Senator Angelique Ashby, current City Council member for Sacramento, Mai Vang, and former Sacramento Mayor Heather Fargo. And they are remembering the late trailblazing council member Lauren Hammond, who passed away last week at the age of 68. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Happy birthday to the University of the Pacific's McGeorge School of Law, celebrating 100 years in Sacramento. It is quite the story. Back in 1924, McGeorge started as a one-room night school, and back then it was called Sacramento College of Law. Now the school is one of the top-ranked international law schools in the West. And you may also remember that McGeorge was home to retired Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy, who was also a professor there from 1965 to 1988. The school is planning several events to mark its centennial. Joining us is Michael Hunter Schwartz, professor and dean of McGeorge School of Law here in Sacramento. And a note, McGeorge is a financial supporter of Cap Radio. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you. It's such a treat. I mean, 100 years. I mean, I knew it had been around for a long time, but 100 years is definitely a feat. You've been the dean at McGeorge now since 2017. So that's like 7 years, give or take, in this role. What have you learned about McGeorge and the role that it plays in Sacramento?
So it's kind of blown me away. When I got to McGeorge, I had no idea we had 400 alumni judges, that we have 14,000 alums, about 4,000 in the greater Sacramento area, and in every area, business law and businesses and government, of course. You had Senator Ashby, who's a McGeorge alum, on right before me. So the impact of McGeorge is enormous, and especially because our students are serving every single department of the government as interns and externs, and they are serving the community in our clinics. We have a clinic that focuses on housing issues. We have a clinic that focuses on...
And these are free legal clinics for people.
They're free. A clinic focuses on elder law, like, recovers about $1.5 million a year for people that lost it to relatives and caretakers.
Wow. So financial abuse as well. I mean, there's a lot of services for the community. It's not just like all the benefits within McGeorge School of Law stay within the campus. You know, they actually go and transcend beyond the campus to the city and just the region. You know, we talked a little bit about the history. I mean, it was like two sentences. It's a century old, 1924, started as a one room night school, obviously has grown exponentially since then. Can you walk us through some of the school's history and key moments?
Yes. So Adrian McGeorge was the founding dean. He served for about 3 or 4 years and then passed away. And I think the board felt really bad that they killed off a young man as dean, which probably tells you everything you need to know about being a dean. And then it was sort of a quiet period for a number of years. And then two major things happened. One is that a Sacramento icon, Gordon Shaber, was named dean of the law school. And the second is that the law school joined the University of the Pacific. And those two things were major transformative things. They led to the law school becoming accredited by the American Bar Association, the American Association of Law Schools. They quickly grew the prestige of the law school, enjoyed one of the highest bar pass rates in the state of California every single year. So the most explosive time was that in that early Dean Shaber year, and he was a miracle. He lasted like 30 years as dean.
Wow, 3 decades. I mean, that's tremendous. When it comes to arguably the most notable person to come out of McGeorge, which is the retired Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy, I mean, I didn't realize that his presence on campus teaching there, am I correct? It's been spans like over 50 years?
Yes, absolutely. So after he stopped teaching in our night program, he started teaching in our summer program in Salzburg. And one of my greatest honors was to get to see him teach in person. He is a great teacher, and you'd be surprised what a kind human being he is as a teacher. Can I tell you a story?
Please.
So he does what every law professor in America has done forever. He calls on a student, asks her a hypothetical question, and she says, What would you do if you were the lawyer? What would you argue? And the woman articulates the argument she would make. And he said, you know, that wasn't what I was looking for. It's better.
Yeah, that encouragement, especially, I mean, I think in all higher education, but law school, I think, is probably hard to come by. So I think that's very, very much appreciated. You know, I would imagine Justice Kennedy is the longest serving faculty member. I mean, does he stay connected with the school these days?
He is our longest serving faculty member. He is not teaching for us anymore, but I'm in regular touch with him and his family and his friends. He is a great friend from the law school. Periodically, he'll call me or I'll call him and he'll say, hi, boss, which is the most absurd thing in the world for a Supreme Court justice to say to me. But he's a very gracious person. He has very strong opinions. People say that he and Shaber were two of the three refounders of the law school.
Mm-hmm. You know, if you're a student of law, you know, or aspiring student of law, what makes McGeorge a unique place to learn as opposed to or compared to, you know, other well-known law schools in California, you know, UCLA, Berkeley or Hastings?
So two really big things. One is that we're one of only six schools in the country where to graduate, you have to have two clinic or externship experiences, two, three semesters of legal writing. Three, we have an alumni student mentoring program that's a required part of our curriculum. So one side is the practical training. That's really been our brand for our entire existence. And then the other side is that, and this is really, you know, aligns with what you said about Justice Kennedy's teaching, we're actually a very supportive law school. So like before finals every fall, the faculty, staff, and administration cook our favorite side dishes and desserts. And I do that and cover the cost of the main course. And we serve it to students to wish them good luck on finals.
Oh, that's wonderful. Because I've had some friends who have gone to law school and I have felt vicariously that stress that they go through for those 3 years. That also includes hoping to pass the bar on the first try. You know, McGeorge students, I mean, they've had a high pass rate of this bar exam. I think it's the highest pass rate in like a quarter century, 25 years. What do you attribute that to?
The faculty at McGeorge has really put a lot of work into supporting student success on the bar exam. The reality is people go to law school because they want to become practitioners. And so that's the bar, both literally and figuratively. So we have a post-graduation program that's free to students to help them pass the bar in addition to their bar review course. We have a scholarship for students who can't afford to take time off from work to study for the bar. And we have a scholarship. If students do everything we recommend that they do to study for the bar, they get a $500 reimbursement toward the cost of their bar review course.
Oh, wow. You know, I mean, because what you're really hitting at is barriers and accessibility, right? You know, I mean, going to law school is very expensive. You know, having the time and the bandwidth to really devote to studying and passing the bar. But, you know, you're helping make those in a pun or figure the bar lower, like those hurdles, you know, more achievable.
Yes, we seem to be playing with that bar metaphor a lot. But yes, and there's a lot more that we do to support student success. When I went to law school, they said, you know, one final exam at the end of an entire year. We have finals at the end of each semester, plus midterms in the first semester, plus practice midterms, plus practice midterms. So, and we put every student into a structured study group facilitated by an upper division student. So really focused on caring for and supporting the students.
Yeah, not just getting into law school, but actually creating an environment where they can get out of law school and pass the bar, which is great. Finally, I mean, 100 years. I mean, are there any events planned to celebrate this huge milestone?
Oh, your timing is great. Tonight, we have the second event of our centennial celebrations. Dean Erwin Chemerinsky is coming over from Berkeley. He's going to give a talk arguing that we should start over with the Constitution and publish something in our law review about that. Last week, we had a toast to our 100th anniversary, we had arranged something with our Conservatory of Music to do a flash mob song.
Fun. See, law students can be fun. Law school can be fun. Thank you so much, Dean Schwartz.
Thank you so much for having me.
And congratulations. Happy centennial.
Thank you very much.
Michael Hunter Schwartz is the professor and dean of the University of the Pacific's McGeorge School of Law, and they are celebrating 100 years. And a note, McGeorge is a financial supporter of CAP Radio. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, you can reach out to us. Send us an email, insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Sarit Lashinsky and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer and audio engineer is Chris Feltz. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great Wednesday. We'll catch you right back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.